Welcome to episode 4 and the final installment of the Foreign Desk's summer series, in which we examine historical events as the Foreign Desk might have covered them at the time, working only from the information which would have been available to us. This week, we go back to 1979 and the beginnings of the Iran hostage crisis. Ramita Navai, journalist and author of City of Lies, Love, Sex, Death and the Search for Truth in Tehran, plays Monocle's correspondent in the Iranian capital. Holly Dagrez, senior fellow at the Atlantic Council and curator of the Iranist newsletter, plays an analyst based in Tehran. Vali Nasser, former US State Department advisor and professor of Middle East Studies at Johns Hopkins University, plays a foreign policy expert based in Washington, D.C. And Lou Lukens, former US ambassador to Senegal and Guinea-Bissau, now senior partner at Signum Global Advisors, plays a foreign policy expert based in London. In our parallel universe, this episode broadcasts on Saturday, November 10th, 1979. Last Sunday, November 4th, protesters climbed over the walls of the US embassy compound in Tehran. The mob who stormed the building appear to be adherents of the Ayatollah Ruhollah Khomeini, a hardline Shia cleric who returned to Iran in February after years in exile, shortly after Iran's previous ruler, Shah Mohammad Reza Pahlavi, fled the country after months of tumult. As we go to air, dozens of people are being held hostage, including perhaps 60 or so American citizens. Their captors are demanding the return of the Shah, presently undergoing medical treatment in the United States, to face revolutionary justice. The seizure of the embassy has already had seismic effects on Iran's domestic politics. Prime Minister Mehdi Bazargan, appointed by the Ayatollah Khomeini, has resigned in apparent protest at the overrunning of the embassy, along with his cabinet. There is no longer any doubt that Khomeini is seeking to remake Iran in his own forbidding image. A strident anti-Americanism was already a feature of Khomeini's nascent Islamic Republic, but this week's events are a heady raising of the stakes. The taking of an embassy and the kidnapping of diplomats is certainly a provocation, arguably an act of war. US President Jimmy Carter finds a gauntlet at his feet. Where is the Ayatollah Khomeini going with this? What are President Carter's options? And how, why, and when did relations between the United States and Iran deteriorate to this perilous point? This is the Foreign Desk.
It's an extraordinary scene here. Now there have been crowds of protesters turning up every day, lots of banners hanging outside the embassy, there's graffiti on the walls, down with the USA, and you can see some of the walls are blackened from when the demonstrators set fire to parts of the compound.
There's a lot of anger at the United States, and I think it's impossible to say at this point whether this will be a couple day event or if it will last longer.
You're listening to The Foreign Desk. I'm Andrew Muller. For an update, first of all, on the latest from Tehran, I'm joined by our reporter on the scene, Ramita Navai. Ramita, describe for us, if you will, the scene around the embassy compound right now. What is the atmosphere like on the ground?
Andrew, it's an extraordinary scene here. Now there have been crowds of protesters turning up every day. Lots of banners hanging outside the embassy, there's graffiti on the walls, down with the USA. And you can see some of the walls are blackened from when the demonstrators set fire to parts of the compound. There are also journalists camped out here because the hostage takers, as you know, have been giving press conferences. Now, the compound itself is being heavily guarded by armed students to make sure no hostages can escape, so nobody can get in, nobody can get out. And these are young religious men who are supporters of Ayatollah Khomeini.
Now, this began with these demonstrators we saw last Sunday, November the 4th. Do you get the sense that the seizure of the embassy was a spontaneous act by people caught up in the moment, or was this something that seemed to have been quite carefully planned in advance?
It may have looked spontaneous. So Ayatollah Khomeini had called on his supporters to attack US interests. And so the protesters dutifully turned up here at the US embassy. But as the situation's been progressing and we're getting more information, it seems that this was carefully orchestrated and well planned. Now, we're hearing that three Islamic leftist student leaders are behind this. I've also been hearing that not all the students who are part of this agreed with the plan, but they went along with it anyway. Now, one young man in particular was against this plan. His name is Mahmoud Ahmadinejad. Now, he's a striking young man, Andrew, for his strident conservatism. He wanted the students to take over the embassy of the Soviet Union.
How was it actually possible for any amount of people to overrun the embassy, which one would assume would be fairly well guarded, that there would be US Marines on the premises? And of course, this isn't the first time that demonstrators have had a pop at the US embassy. There was a seizure, a very brief one, earlier this year.
You're right, Andrew. Now, about 9 months ago on February the 14th, right after the Shah's government was toppled, the embassy was pretty violently attacked by crowds. They ransacked the building, smashed equipment, and forced staff to lie on the floor at gunpoint. One Iranian embassy employee was killed, a US Marine and three other Americans were wounded. Now, this could be why the demonstrators managed to take control of the embassy so easily this time, because the US Marines and the guards were all too aware that there was no way of fighting back. But this should have been a warning sign. The protesters sprayed the embassy building with gunfire, and all the US Marines could do was fire back with birdshot. And even then, the US Ambassador William Sullivan ordered the Marines to put down their weapons. Now, it does seem unbelievable that the seizure of the US embassy by mostly unarmed protesters happened so quickly and with such ease. But we know, like last time, that the guards did try to defend the compound with tear gas, and that's because they're not allowed to use firearms. Now, the students have released some of the hostages, including one Iranian interpreter who's been speaking to journalists. She says that the demonstrators just walked into the compound this time and nobody stopped them. Now, she says the staff were taken to a maximum security floor and given gas masks. But around 2 hours later, students stormed the building and the Marines let them in the room where the staff were cowering.
You were saying earlier that the students who took the embassy, or at least their representatives, have been giving press conferences. How clear have they been about what they want and what their intentions are now?
Very clear. They're demanding the extradition of the Shah. One of their spokespeople said the embassy staff would be held until the US government returned the Shah to Iran to stand trial. Now, the students have said if the request is not met, they will take measures against the hostages in line with public opinion. Now, not only do they not seem to fear America's response, they seem incredibly emboldened and brazen.
The key figure lurking behind this, of course, is the Ayatollah Khomeini, and we will be discussing him more later in the show. But is it your sense that he is directing this or following it? Because there does seem quite a clear split in that he is a man of several generations ahead of the revolutionaries you are describing. Are they genuinely following him, or have events got away from him?
Well, he doesn't seem to be directing it, but we know he's closely following the situation. He's already issued a statement of support. We also know that just 3 days ago, on November the 7th, Ayatollah Khomeini refused to meet with U.S. former Attorney General Ramsey Clark and the Senate Intelligence Committee director sent by President Carter to negotiate the release of the hostages. Now, while the Ayatollah may have not known about these plans, it seems highly likely that people around him knew. Now, I'm hearing reports that the students behind this sought approval from a high-ranking cleric close to Khomeini. Now, he's rumored to have told them to go ahead and occupy the nest of spies, as the U.S. embassy here is being called, and he assured them that Khomeini would support them once they had taken control, which he's done.
From where we are now, does this strike you as something that the Iranian revolutionaries will stand down from once they feel like they've made their point? Or could this one go on for a while?
Well, the students here seem serious. Yesterday, a hostage was paraded outside the embassy, was blindfolded, his hands were bound. And crucially, unlike last time, when demonstrators seized the embassy and the acting foreign minister stepped in, that's not happening this time. So that's what makes me think that they're in for the long haul. Most importantly, they are desperate for the Shah to be returned to stand trial here. And it really does look like until their demands are met, they're not going anywhere.
Ramita Navai, thank you for joining us. That was Monocle's correspondent in Tehran, Ramita Navai. One does not need a long memory to recall a time when the United States and Iran seemed like allies, or at least a time when their governments did. President Carter saw in the 1978 New Year as a guest of the Shah at the Niavaran Palace complex in northern Iran. Let's have a quick reminder of some of what President Carter had to say.
Iran, because of the great leadership of the Shah, is an island of stability in one of the more troubled areas of the world. This is a great tribute to you, Your Majesty, and to your leadership, and to the respect and the admiration and love which your people give to you.
That was President Jimmy Carter with an assessment of the U.S.-Iran relationship, which does not appear to have aged altogether brilliantly. Joining me now from her home in Tehran to explain how and why relations between the two countries have soured so comprehensively is the political analyst Holly Dagraz. Holly, obviously the events of the last few days have not come out of a clear blue sky, despite the apparent bonhomie that existed until quite recently between Washington and Tehran. What is going on now seems a pretty unsurprising endpoint of a lot of the anti-American hostility which has accompanied the revolution in Iran. So from the point of view of the people who have enacted this hostage-taking, where does this anti-American sentiment come from?
Well, Andrew, I think it's been decades in the making. Arguably, it started with the 1953 coup against Prime Minister Mohammad Mossadegh, in which the CIA backed. But looking at it more recently, the 1960s, the Shah actually imposed what he called a white revolution, which was these list of reforms that were pushed by the United States, including land reforms and women's suffrage rights. And those things were actually good for the Iranian people, but it actually rubbed the clergy the wrong way, in part because they also had quite a bit of land in their name. But as time went on and Iran became more developed under the Pahlavi dynasty, we actually saw more Americans coming to Iran and getting more involved in developing the country, but also taking on a very, I would say, arrogant look at the Iranian people. And there were stories of Americans acting not appropriately in certain scenarios. But what actually made things worse is that at the end of the day, Iran was a somewhat traditional society, especially in the rural parts of the country. And when the country developed and westernized under the Shah, there was definitely a divide. And a lot of that was seen through the lens of things like Coca-Cola, nightclubs and bars. So this was actually something that was long time in the making, that Iranians felt that they were losing their sense of identity. And I think there was a word for it. I've been reading some of the analysis in some of the newspapers over the past months, but this concept of Gharb Zadegi, or West toxification. And so this sentiment was growing over time, and essentially this is what the American, or as the rhetoric these days on the ground in Tehran is, the imperialist rhetoric of the U.S. has imposed on the country.
It strikes me that there's a tale of two Iranian rulers in the background here. There is Mohammad Mossadegh, who the Americans seem to have played some role in removing, and then there is the Shah of Iran, who the Americans clearly played a role in supporting. Now, the Shah is a very familiar figure on the world stage in 1979. Mohammad Mossadegh, though, I think may be a slightly more obscure figure to a lot of our listeners. So basically, who was he? Why was he unacceptable to the United States and other Western powers? And at this point, what do we know for certain about how involved those powers were in removing him?
Mohammad Mossadegh was Iran's prime minister between 1951 and 53, and he wasn't a household name until he actually stood against, I would say, the British by actually deciding to nationalize the country's oil. Now, the British Empire actually had a big holding on Iran. They owed 51% under the Anglo-Iranian Oil Company, and being anti-imperialist himself, actually wanted to change things because he thought that this was an unfair cut to the Iranian people. So when he nationalized Iranian oil, this became a big problem. Initially, he was a topic of conversations because he was taking this big stance against the British Empire. But long story short, it was a banned group, the Tudeh Party, which had communist leanings, and his relationship with him in order to secure this nationalization of Iranian oil that actually rubbed the American government the wrong way because of the Red Scare at the time and the Cold War, and they felt that actually Iran was becoming more communist. And so essentially the CIA actually backed a coup in 1953 that ousted Mohammad Mossadegh, and he was put under house arrest and actually died in 1967. But unfortunately, that had actually paved the Iran from a constitutional monarchy to an autocracy, which we're now dealing with. But when we're looking at the big picture here with the events of Mossadegh and the CIA, I think one thing that really stands out also for the Iranians is the fact that the Shah's secret police, the SAVAK, actually were trained by the CIA, and so they see this police state that was formed under the Shah. Unfortunately, this has been a very big problem for the Iranian people for a long time. My own family has shared stories with me of basically not being able to speak their mind at dinner parties or even publicly in the streets because they're afraid that their own family members or friends or anyone could actually report them to the SAVAK. And I remember one specific incident from the past couple years where my family had a dinner party, which I wasn't present at, and the power had suddenly gone out and they heard gunfire, and there was this sound of water shortly after, and it was what they had learned was that a group of students had been gunned down in the streets and the fire department had showed up to wash away the blood. So this was what it was like living under the Shah's police state, and one of the reasons why Iranians were not happy with the U.S. government.
That being the case, do we understand how it was possible for the Ayatollah to maintain a support base from exile?
Well, it's really interesting how these events unfolded. We're now learning a lot more as the days of the revolution continue, but essentially, this was, in a way, the Shah's own making when Ayatollah Khomeini was exiled to Turkey and then later to Iraq. He actually made the access easier for Khomeini. And basically, when Iranians would go on pilgrimage to Shia holy sites in Iraq, they would attend his lectures or get a hold of his cassette tapes of him speaking, his sermons. And these were actually smuggled back to Iran, and they were copied and shared, and the average Iranian couldn't afford a television, but what they could afford was a radio, or they could go to a mosque and hear these lectures. And so these ideas that Khomeini discussed, this idea of a Hukumat Islami or an Islamic government, though, were actually being shared to the masses, and they were largely being ignored by the SAVAK because they didn't feel it was a threat at the time.
Obviously, we don't know how things are going to unfold on the ground in Tehran. We don't know whether the hostages will be released as soon as the Ayatollah and his supporters feel like they've made whatever their point is. As you see it, is antagonizing the United States important in building the kind of Iran they want to build?
Thus far, looking at the events of the past few days, I'm surprised that the crisis has gone on for as long as it has. And It's quite shocking to analysts like myself here in Tehran right now that this would continue as long as it did. And I think right now we're waiting to see what the Carter administration decides, because, of course, the students that are occupying the embassy are calling for the Shah to be returned and put on trial, and I assume that would lead to his execution. And so I think the Carter administration, an ally of the Shah, recognizes that this is a big problem and that this is not something that they should be taking part in. So it's something that I think we're all watching very closely, and we're hoping and praying turns out for the best for these U.S. embassy personnel that are currently being held at the embassy. What we really should be thinking about here is, what is the end game? What happens if they do not decide to hand over the Shah, which I assume will be the case? How far do they want to take this? Because it's clear that on the ground here that there is actually disputes between some of the secular politicians that he's been working with. We've already seen Prime Minister Mehdi Bozargan resign the other day over this matter. So it's clearly causing a lot of problems within his coalition. So I guess we're going to have to wait and see what happens.
Holly, thank you. That was the political analyst Holly Dagres. Do stay with us. You're listening to The Foreign Desk with me, Andrew Muller. It is an axiom of American politics that very few easy decisions end up on the desk of the US president. Even by that standard, however, President Jimmy Carter now has to choose from a menu of profoundly unappetizing options. Capitulation, even negotiation, would look like weakness. A mission to rescue the hostages, if possible at all, would be a horrendous risk. Any kind of demonstration of American military might very well look like, or indeed be, an overreaction. That's all before one considers the vulnerability of those Americans now captive in Iran. So what can President Carter do, especially as he faces a campaign to win re-election next year, likely against a relatively hawkish Republican, perhaps former CIA Director George Bush or former California Governor Ronald Reagan? Here with me in the studio to look at what President Carter actually can do now is the U.S. foreign policy expert Lou Lukens, and he's joined by Vali Nasser, who joins us on the line from Washington, D.C. Lou, I'll start with you here in London. What I think is probably important to establish before we look at the United States' options is what the Iranian revolutionaries' intentions might be. Is it your read that they might give the U.S. embassy back when they think they've made whatever their point is? Or could it be that taking the U.S. embassy is the point?
Well, it's hard to say right now, Andrew, but look, honestly, there's sort of two triggers, I think, to this event. One is the more immediate trigger of the United States letting the Shah come in for medical treatment, which has obviously upset the revolutionaries. But there's the much longer-term issue of U.S. support for the Shah over many, many years, and there's a lot of anger at the United States. And I think it's impossible to say at this point whether this will be a couple-day event or if it will last longer.
Vali, as Lou suggests, the putative demand of the revolutionaries who've taken the embassy is that the United States return the Shah. But there doesn't seem to be any real prospect of the United States agreeing to that in a million years, does there?
No, it's not likely. There is no precedent for it. And also within the United States, there would be those who would severely criticize President Carter for such an act. It would be seen as weakness. And also, the Shah came to the United States with the help of American friends, David Rockefeller, Henry Kissinger, and they had coordinated with the administration in order to gain him entry into the United States.
So just to follow that up, Vali, because this might end up being important, do we think the people who have taken the embassy or the people who have instructed the taking of the embassy actually understand that there is no way the United States is going to send the Shah back?
Not necessarily. These are not people who have a great deal of experience with American foreign policy. They are very confident in their own revolutionary ideas, and also they are quite paranoid. There is an overhang of what they believe happened in 1953, which is that the United States orchestrated a military coup that brought the Shah back from exile and put him back on the throne. And they were particularly agitated when, just before the Shah's arrival in the United States and the taking of the embassy, during the funeral of the president of Algeria, Houari Boumediene, Zbigniew Brzezinski met with the more moderate revolutionary prime minister of Iran, Mehdi Bazargan, who's not part of the cabal that actually took the embassy. And people in Tehran began to suspect in their own mind that some kind of a conspiracy is going on that includes the more moderate pro-democracy faction of the revolution, perhaps the Shah and the United States. So to them, they're trying to block that conspiracy.
Well, Lou, let's move on to the list of options now sitting on President Carter's desk. There are some obvious enough things that he might do in the short term, and there is already some suggestion that he will halt the US's oil imports from Iran, or he might freeze Iranian assets held in the United States. Is any of that kind of thing, though, likely to change the mind of the kind of people he's up against, who are, as we have established, a pretty zealous bunch?
Yeah, that's exactly the challenge. I don't think that the people who've taken over the embassy will care one way or the other if the U.S. freezes Iranian assets in the United States. And if anything, it'll agitate them even further. And Jimmy Carter has to be very careful here, because his primary concern is the security and safety of these 60-some Americans who are being held hostage. And he has to try to have a measured response and be forceful, but at the same time, not agitate the revolutionaries so much that they start killing hostages, which would be terrible.
Just to follow that up quickly, Lou, let's establish some parameters here, and let's take a look, first of all, at what might be the most obvious hardline option that Carter could avail himself of, which would be your just flat-out old-school ultimatum, i.e. say something to Tehran along the lines of, you've got 48 hours to let us send in a plane and take our people back, or we're coming down there in no uncertain terms.
Yeah, but again, the problem or the challenge is that he's not, you know, who does he give that ultimatum to? These are student revolutionaries. It's unclear how much support they have from the Ayatollah. The Ayatollah does not necessarily control this mob of angry students. So there's a question of who you issue the ultimatum to. There's also the question of, if you issue an ultimatum and you're completely ignored, you have to be prepared to follow up on that. You know, Jimmy Carter's instinct, I think, is to try to negotiate. As we know, he sent the former attorney general and a diplomat who had served in Iran to try to meet with the leadership in Tehran. They were rebuffed and they didn't have that meeting. But I think Jimmy Carter, his two top foreign policy advisors right now, his Secretary of State, Cy Vance, is very much an old school negotiator, wants to talk things out. And his national security advisor, Brzezinski, is much more hawkish and aggressive. And I think they will be having this discussion right now with the president, both pushing their point of view. And I think Jimmy Carter's instinct is it will be more to talk and try to negotiate his way out of this than to show military strength.
Vali, I guess we have to think about what the coming days and weeks and months might look like. So what does happen if the Iranians just simply hold the Americans for days or weeks or months, or even, ludicrous though the thought seems, years?
The Iranians begin to see great benefit in that for varieties of reasons. One is that they're getting about 3-4 hours of coverage on a daily basis on American television, on radio, in the media. And most of it is sympathetic to the root reasons of what the Iranians claim is the reason they took the hostages. But even if it's not, even if it's critical of Iran, nevertheless, is making this problem bigger and bigger. And that puts pressure on the United States. Secondly, within Iran, the kinds of people who took the embassy increasingly are becoming more and more powerful, because they're the ones who control the hostages, and the entire hostage episode is mobilizing people in the streets. I mean, on a daily basis, there are these large demonstrations in Iran. There is a sense of siege that the revolutionaries create. And the longer they hold on to these hostages, the more they can tell the Iranian people, as well as the Muslims across the Muslim world, that this Islamic revolution is powerful. It is not only has toppled the regime, it has also is now standing up to the United States. It is now the kind of force against quote-unquote imperialism and American world domination that other political forces in the Muslim worlds were not. I mean, there's a sentence that Ayatollah Khomeini says in Persian, which is there's not a damn thing the United States can do. And the longer that the situation persists, the more he looks like a 10 feet tall Saladin standing up to the West. And all of that is to the benefit of Iran and to the benefit of the revolution.
Vali Nasser and Lou Lukens, thank you very much for joining us here on The Foreign Desk. That's it for this episode of The Foreign Desk. We'll be back next week, and look out for The Foreign Desk Explainer, available every Wednesday. The Foreign Desk was produced by Emma Searle and Christy Evans. Christy also produces The Foreign Desk Explainer. From me, Andrew Muller, thanks very much for listening. Until next time, goodbye.